This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. Back in 2019, Boris Johnson ordered a report into how the party handles discrimination allegations and into Islamophobia allegations. And today we've had the findings. James, can you talk us through it?
So this was a review that you might remember. I think Boris Johnson rather bounced into having in that during one of the Tory leadership contest debates, the question was asked, you know, raise your hands if you think there should be a review into Islamophobia in the Tory party. And basically, as I think Sajid Javid was the first hand to go up, and all the hands went up, I think it became inevitable that they were going to have to agree to this. The report is critical. It's critical of Boris Johnson's Daily Telegraph column about women wearing the burqas, which was a defence of their right to wear the burqas, but did remark that they looked a bit like letterboxes or criminals when doing so. Professor Singh, who conducted the review, asked Boris Johnson about this. Boris Johnson says, I think the nearest we've got from him to an apology for some of the things he said journalistically. He said, look, I wouldn't use some of the language I use as a columnist now that I'm Prime Minister. And Professor Singh says, you know, look, That shouldn't be the in the report, says that shouldn't be the test. You know, if you're a senior member of the Tory party, it shouldn't have to be that you become Prime Minister for you to use language more sensitively. So I think there's an interesting question now about whether Boris Johnson goes further. You know, at the moment, what he has apologised for is a form of apology that politicians often like, which is they apologise for any offence caused, rather than apologise for having said the thing. Now, it'd be an interesting question because Boris Johnson is normally very reluctant to get drawn into debates about specific newspaper articles that he wrote. I mean, the calculation he makes is that if he gets into, you know, saying sorry for that one, people will say, well, what about, and then list a whole bunch of other columns going back years. And I think it's also worth remembering that some of the kind of cultural mores about what is and isn't offensive have shifted in time, you know, from when he started writing a newspaper column to now. So I think this review is interesting. But the big question about this review is whether it is sufficient for the EHRC not to launch an investigation into a Tory party over Islamophobia. You may remember that they launched an inquiry into Labour Party anti-Semitism, and lots of people have argued that, you know, they should now launch an inquiry into Tory Party Islamophobia. What the EHRC has said this morning is that they want to look at the report and its terms of reference and how the Tory party responds before making any comment.
Yes, Isabel, in the report it says it found no evidence the party had systematically failed any particular community. So do you think that suggests that this is a different situation to the inevitable comparisons we see between Islamophobia and the Tory party and anti-Semitism and the Labour Party?
Yeah, as you say, it did look at the allegation made by Baroness Barcy and others that the party has a institutional Islamophobia, and it didn't find the evidence for that. It didn't find evidence that complaints that were related to Islam are treated any differently to those related to any other minority or religious groups. But it is really uncomfortable reading for the party. And the line about not just the comments about burqas by the Prime Minister, but also by Zach Goldsmith when he was campaigning to be London mayor, that the report says that these sorts of comments give the impression to many that the party and its leadership are insensitive to Muslim communities. Now, I wonder whether this is going to come up at Prime Minister's questions tomorrow. It might not be something that Sir Keir Starmer wants to raise himself, but you can just see a Labour MP on the backbenches wanting to bring it up. And when this has previously come up, it has descended into a very ugly and unedifying session of your racism is just as bad as mine between the two parties, with the Conservatives shouting about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party and Labour shouting about Islamophobia in the Conservative Party, which doesn't really help anyone and brings a plague on all politicians' houses, really.
And James, when it comes to the next steps by the Conservative Party before we hear from the EHRA, they have said they're going to look at the recommendations. Do you think we're going to see much in terms of any specific actions coming from party HQ in the coming weeks?
The fact that the report has clearly caught the Tory party on the hop, with the Tory party saying they've got it, but then they'll respond this afternoon, I mean, does speak to its independence. I think there was a certain amount of cynicism about this report that was going to be a whitewash. I think it is a bit more critical than people expected. I think there is a question from the Tory party about how they do respond. And I think you can quite clearly tell EHRC are trying to basically say to the Tory party, if we don't think you're doing very much in response to this report, we are more likely to launch an investigation. So that's clearly designed to put the pressure on the Tory party to act.
Now, meanwhile, Isabel, when it comes to the Indian variant and the great unlocking, we saw the government move last week away from the idea of local lockdowns. Yet there are some questions now as to whether we're getting local lockdowns in all but name only. 8 COVID areas have been urged not to have indoor gatherings, urged people not to travel into and out of these areas. And these include Bedford, Burnley, North Tyneside.
But no one in those local areas, none of the local authorities, the MPs involved, public health officials, were told about this new guidance saying that people should avoid travelling in and out unless it's essential. And I think it was picked up by a journalist for the Manchester Evening News, who then got in touch with public health directors in Bolton, which is one of the areas subject to these restrictions, and they didn't know what was going on, which has obviously not gone down well anywhere. I think there has been an acceptance that this could have been communicated better, but I think better is doing quite a lot of hard work there, because it doesn't seem to have been communicated at all. And we have discussed many times on this podcast how much MPs hate local lockdowns. I'm not sure that the way to have a local lockdown is just to do one without telling them and hope they don't notice. So that's probably a way to make them hate it even more, as well as for it to not work.
And James, when it comes to the situation we're in, there has been a growing sense that Number 10 are not so worried by the Indian variant. The vaccines appear to work against it. It's a little bit less transmissible than first feared. But the fact that these restrictions, you could call them, I suppose if you could say that they're invisible, but you could also say, you know, guidance is now in place. Does that suggest there is greater concern than some imagined?
I think you are right, Katie, that the concern about the Indian variant is not as great as when it was first discovered. Jonathan Van Tam, Deputy Chief Medical Officer, said he thinks it is considerably less transmissible than 50% more transmissible. And if it turned out to be 20%, say, more transmissible than the Kentish variant, then I think you could say, and given what we know about vaccine efficacy, and then I think, you know, most models would suggest it would be kind of safe to proceed with the roadmap in these circumstances. I think, as well, I hit the nail on the head when she talked about this advice, which is, how long are we into this crisis? We're like over a year into it now. I mean,
well over a year, I think.
Well over a year into it. It is amazing how unjoined up some things still are. I think, as Isabel pointed out, it is remarkable that you have advice telling people not to travel to or from certain parts of the country, and neither their MPs nor their local councils were aware of this advice. If the people who are literally paid to know this stuff don't know it, what chance is there of a general population in these places knowing it? I mean, I would suggest close to zero. And I think that is problematic. I also think one of the things we've found about local lockdowns is they're just not effective. It was slightly the Hotel California of the COVID restrictions, in that places went into them and never left. So they never seemed to be tough enough to kind of properly curb the virus. And so I think that is difficult. But I think there are lots of interesting questions thrown up here, which is, you know, what happens when a new variant... So let's just imagine a post-June 21st world. And let's imagine a new variant is discovered somewhere. I think there will be a lot of debate about what the right approach is. If there was a cluster of cases found somewhere, I think lots of people would say, look, don't endanger a national reopening and basically surround this place and refuse to let people leave. I mean, almost. And I think you can see this argument beginning to gear up. Nicola Sturgeon is already trying to pass laws in the Scottish Parliament that would say that when Scots come to England, there are certain places, for example, Bolton, that they couldn't go to. Now, I'm uncertain what the legal basis for the Scottish government being able to tell Scottish citizens where they can go when they cross the border into England is. But I think this question is going to get very interesting, which is, as you reopen, what do you do if you get a cluster of cases in a place? Is that place kind of quarantined off from the rest of the country until there's more evidence of how effective the vaccines are against that variant? Or is it allowed to kind of continue interacting with the rest of the country as normal?
Now, finally, Isabel, tomorrow Dominic Cummings will be giving evidence to MPs, and today marks a year since the Rose Garden press conference where Dominic Cummings had to field lots of questions about his trip to Barnard Castle. I suppose, looking back, lots of people sharing their memories of the day. Do you think that that event ultimately changed the course of history in the sense that the government looks different today because of those events?
I think it definitely changed a lot of people's attitudes towards the guidance and the reliability of the government following that. And I think it's, you know, a lot of cabinet ministers will be wishing that they had been more clear-sighted in their defence of Dominic Cummings, given that they are now all bracing themselves for him to go in all guns blazing tomorrow in this committee hearing against the government. A lot of them spent some political capital defending him personally last year and will perhaps wish that they hadn't done that.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.